On today's episode of Aviator Cast, we are joined by Major John Rain Waters.
Welcome, aviators, to another episode of Aviator Cast. Load up your flight bag with useful flight training topics, interviews, and aviation passion. Let's kick the tires and light the fires. Coming to you from Angle of Attack Headquarters in Homer, Alaska, here's your host and flight instructor, Chris Palmer.
Welcome, aviators, to another episode of Aviator Cast. My name is Chris Palmer. It's my pleasure to welcome you here. Today, we have an awesome guest with us today, someone that I look up to quite literally, especially at these air shows that he performed at in the past. Major John Rain Waters, who very recently was an F-16 demo pilot. You may have seen him at some of these air shows. He's now flying the 777 for a cargo carrier, and he is an all-around true American patriot and fought for our country in some ways that I'm sure we'll never fully appreciate. And we get in pretty deep into some of the intricacies of training to become a fighter pilot. It is a long, many years long process that I think a lot of us, even in the civilian space, can learn a lot about. So if you're interested in becoming a military pilot, or you want to learn from someone like John, this is a perfect opportunity to do that. We have a great conversation, and I can't thank him enough for coming on for you guys. As a quick note before we get started, I want to see those reviews coming in more because I know a lot of you guys are listening, so I'm going to up the ante a little bit. If you leave a review on AviatorCast, on iTunes, Spotify, or somewhere else, I'm going to start to read those reviews on the show. If I read your review on the show, I will send you guys one of these Angle of Attack hats or a t-shirt from Angle of Attack. So if I read your review on the show, I'll send you guys some merch. So go ahead and go and leave a review, and that'll help out this podcast a ton. I mean, maybe you could do it even out of the goodness of your heart, even if you weren't going to get some merch. But anyway, I'm happy to send you guys stuff. So anyway, please go and do that. Really appreciate you guys and all you do. And I really appreciate Major John Rain Waters for being with us today. So let's dive right in and get to know him a little bit and more about his journey. All right, everyone, we are honored to have a very special guest with us today. We have John Waters with us. How you doing, John?
Doing good. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Absolutely. Thanks for jumping on short notice. I messaged you yesterday, and then you were the first person to sign up today. So being Monday. So yeah, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if I don't do it now, then something's going to pop up, and then it'll be a month from now we're trying to make it happen. So I had the time, so happy to be here.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate it. So give us a little bit of background, just like a quick elevator pitch on John. Like, what have you been known for? What are you doing now?
Yeah, so I started flying in high school. Got the bug hooked, and I wanted to go serve my country. So best of both worlds, I was able to go fly in the Air Force. I spent 12 years flying in the Air Force, mix from being a T-6 instructor pilot to going out, flying the F-16, then eventually being the F-16 demo pilot. And I just recently transitioned into the airlines, and I'm flying a 777 right now.
Right on. Very cool. Yeah. So let's start at the beginning then. So you started flying in high school. Tell us about where you got the bug and how that love for aviation started.
I grew up in a community that was just full of aviation. A lot of Delta pilots around where I live and all are like ex-Air Force and ex-Navy guys. And my neighbor actually took me flying in a Piper Cub, but a day was like 70 degrees and absolutely beautiful. Door open, went cruising around. And I think that was like the first hook I had put in me for aviation. My dad was a big influence. He wasn't a pilot, but he saw it as a great career opportunity and kind of pushed me in that direction. And so I was fortunate to have someone who wanted to teach a friend of mine how to fly, his son. He wanted to teach his son how to fly, but he wanted to teach him to fly with someone. So I was fortunate to be able to be that other person. And me and my friend were taught how to fly. My first flight was on September 10th, 2001. So The next day, it was a big moment for so many people across the world, let alone America. So when September 11th happened, that really solidified my desire to want to go serve. And if I could go serve while flying, it was two birds with one stone. And I was fortunate. That's kind of where I put all my effort in high school, was to get an ROTC scholarship, go in, get a pilot slot, and then fly in the Air Force.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think for me, connection to 9/11, I think I took my first flight lesson a year after that. So yeah, September 11th, 2002. So pretty wild.
And it's crazy. Now we're coming up. I mean, it's almost two decades ago.
Right.
And so there's so many people that, you know, I mean, obviously our age know it, lived it. Everyone older than us know it and lived it. But, you know, being the demo pilot, going out and talking to kids now, there's just, we now have the first generation of Americans serving in the military who were born after September 11th.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's such a big event and moment in history for so many people. And it's crazy to hear the different stories. I need to go dig up my logbook and like take a picture of it and share it or something, cause it is kind of wild.
I remember another friend of mine that has a similar story to you. He was working in the financial sector. 9/11 happened, and then he became an Air Force pilot as well. He ended up in the Raptor, but you know, he felt the call as well. So, can you walk us through what the process for you was like, say in high school, to get to that point where you're qualifying to be a fighter pilot? I don't know if that's like an acceptable term, but you know, no, like you're obviously shooting for something there. So what's that process like to actually get in a position to be able to do that?
So for me, and I think most people, the average is a very long process. There obviously is exceptions to it. Someone who might already have their degree and applies to officer training school, which is a shorter condensed program, and they go off and become a pilot. But on average, most people commission, become officers in the Air Force, which you had to be an officer to be a pilot. Most people commission either through the Air Force Academy, which is a four-year college military school out in Colorado Springs, or through ROTC, which is at most universities across the nation. So I did ROTC at Georgia Tech, but you start queuing yourself up in high school because you have to be competitive in order to get into ROTC or get into the Air Force Academy. So mine started really like eighth, ninth grade, looking to see what the requirements were in order to get a ROTC scholarship or get into the Air Force Academy, which is good GPAs, good SAT, be well-rounded. So be involved in sports or working, but they also want to see in those processes of work or your club or sports that over the course of 3 or 4 years, you go from, you know, the guy who just joined the group to being the club president or being the team captain, because they're looking for leadership ability. So it really queued up early on, and it was a long path just to get to ROTC and get into college. And then once you get into ROTC or college or the Air Force Academy, the process kind of starts all over again, because you're competing with everyone who's shown up. At the end of school, you know, your junior year, that's really when most people find out what they're going to go do in the Air Force. So you have 3 years to develop as a leader, develop as an officer, show that you have that potential to serve at a higher level and function at a higher level. And then you apply for a pilot slot or a navigator slot or intelligence officer, whatever it might be, but you've been racked and stacked against your peers. There's a number one, there's a number two, there's a number 10, and it all comes down to the needs of the Air Force. So if we need 10 pilots, great news for that group of 10 people. But if there's only a need for two pilots, then the top two people are going to get that. That's a very, I guess, broad brush scale, but in the end, it's a really long process typically in order to get to that point.
And it's a big investment too, right? Without being, you know, guaranteed that you're actually going to get that slot. You're putting in years and years of work before you ever know that you're going to get a pilot slot.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, there are definitely stories out there that are heartbreaking when you hear about it. And I had a couple friends who, much better human beings than me, much smarter, much more talented, but they would either get right to the end of, they would get awarded a pilot slot. Well, the next tripping point is to go get a flying medical done by the military. And there are there are a decent amount of people that discover they have some underlying issue that wasn't an issue for them. Maybe it was a heart murmur or something like that, that precludes them from being a pilot. So they lose that opportunity. And that's why I think for me, it definitely very fortunate to be able to do what I was able to do in the Air Force and still do it today. And really anyone who flies, because there's so many little things, I guess let's say little, but some things that typically go unnoticed until you go get some kind of rigorous physical that pop up that now prevents you from being a pilot.
Is there any way to go through that physical beforehand, like at the Air Force standard, so you know?
They do initial screening. So like it just gets more thorough once, hey, you're awarded a pilot slot. I think it was like a 3-day process of exams. I mean, they use some kind of super solution to dilute your eyes and or dilate your eyes and you know, you have to sit there for 6 hours and they're doing all sorts of tests. Hmm. But early on, they do initial screening where they try and catch big ticket items, if you will, like, hey, you have a heart defect that you didn't realize. So this is going to be an issue for you to serve, period. So they just kind of go ahead and remove them from the program or don't let them, I guess, participate. So that is how they do it. And apparently that's like the most cost efficient way because the numbers are there.
Right. Yeah. I have a friend too, that went through that recently on the Coast Guard side. And she found out that she had color blindness of some level and she was out, like worked so hard. And then she was out. It was a real bummer.
Yeah, it's crushing. And that's what I think. I definitely took it for granted that everything medically was just there for me until I saw, you know, actually I had a good friend who was going through pilot training, doing really well. And he developed type 1 diabetes halfway through. He just started getting sick and it took about a month for them to figure out what it was. But then he was done. I mean, he was medically disqualified from the Air Force. Like it was over. And there's just some things like that. Again, I know I took for granted. I try not to take it for granted today because I realize how precious having that medical certificate is. And the minute you lose it, how detrimental it is to your career, your aspirations, and you got to figure out something else.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a whole other storyline there. You know, I went through medical stuff too as a teenager. And so I knew pretty early I was disqualified because I thought the military might be a great place to go. So there are some previous podcasts people can look back toward to kind of look at that on my story. So from there, so you've gone through kind of the high school ROTC, you've gone through the college ROTC. What's the process like from there once you realize that you get a pilot slot?
So again, in your third year on average, that's when you're going to find out what you're going to go do in the Air Force. You'll be awarded a pilot slot and then you'll be divvied up between what bases you're going to go to. So for the Air Force right now, our primary pilot training bases are Columbus Air Force Base in Mississippi, Laughlin Air Force Base in Texas, Vance Air Force Base in Oklahoma. And then I need to figure out if we're still, I don't think we're actually sending anyone to Pensacola. We used to do a joint thing with the Navy. We're sending a couple of people down there. So you'll finish up your senior year of college and then you'll go down to one of these pilot training bases where you'll spend roughly a year. If the timing all works out, I waited 15 months before I started pilot training. So I actually graduated from Georgia Tech. The Air Force sent me down to Moody Air Force Base in Georgia, where I hung out with the combat rescue squadron, flying around in helicopters and seeing what that world was like for a year and just kind of helping out, like fill the snack bar and things like that. And then I went to pilot training. So everyone's story is like a little bit different. There's usually like delays to get there. But once you show up to pilot training, you're going to spend about a year. You're going to go 6 weeks roughly of academics, learning, you know, physiology, learning the systems of the planes, taking tests, things like that. And then your class of roughly like 30 other pilots or pilot students, you're going to be split into two groups called flights. You're going to go through T6 training. So that's where you're going to learn basic aerobatics, in which we're just trying to teach handling, performance, feel the aircraft, things like that. But you're going to go out there and do Cuban 8s and stuff like that. There's really no application in the military sense other than left hand, right hand monkey skills. They'll learn formation flying, instrument flying, and that takes about 5 months ish. That program is kind of, it is changing right now because the Air Force for 50 years, we produced pilots one way and one way only. And it was our way or the highway. Now the Air Force is leveraging technology, augmented reality, things like that. We're trying to streamline that 1 year process to produce a pilot saying, hey, maybe you're really sharp. We can cut out these rides because you get it and you can move faster through the program or vice versa. But again, you're going to spend roughly 5 or 6 months flying the T6. At that point, that's when everyone splits. So they're going to go to the T-38, which is the fighter bomber trainer predominantly. Although again, now we do send people to C-17s and tankers from the T-38. And then there's the T1 track, which is a Hawker Beechcraft. And that is what it was traditionally, a cargo tanker trainer plane. And we'll send a few people to go fly UH-1s down at Fort Rucker with the Army for the helicopter. But again, it's going to be T6s halfway through. You're going to split and go to the T38 or T1 track and a few to the UH-1. Spend another 5 months learning to fly those planes. And then you'll be assigned your major weapon system, whether it be an F-16, a C-17, a C-130, whatever it might be. And then you'll go into that schoolhouse and those vary in length too.
So you went to T-38, is that right? At that point? It
is. Okay. Yeah. So after T-6s, I went to T-38s. And then they liked me so much. They kept me for 3 years afterwards to teach in the T-6. So
nice.
Two of us stayed back out of my, so when I was going through, we had 2 out of 30 go to the T-38. We actually washed back a class to build a big enough T-38 class. And out of our 8 students in T-38s, we all kind of divvied it. We had some international students and things like that, but we had one guy go fighters, 2 guys go back to the T-6 to instruct for 3 years, FAPES, first assignment instructor pilots. And then we actually had the first heavy drop in T-38s and at Columbus and Air Force history. That's like 12 years ago now, or 13 years ago now. Yeah.
So what's the most interesting part of that training? Like, is it the T-6? Is it the T-38? Where did you go from the T-38?
So the T-38 actually went back to the T-6 and I actually went to instruct. But
right.
I would say, so for pilot training and different, so I didn't go through a formal civilian course. Like I had a dad's friend teach me. So right. There was no syllabus or anything like that. So going into the Air Force is very regimented. There is a syllabus. We would start out, it's like a guaranteed 12-hour day. So maybe we were flying starting at 5 a.m. and run until 5 p.m. Or maybe we're starting at 9 a.m. and we're going until 9 p.m. But for the first part of your T-6 training, we call it formal release. And you're basically in the flight room the entire time. The balance is there are going to be people that get it faster than others. Some people are really going to struggle. There's a dichotomy of like egos and things like that are coming into it. Every class is a little bit different. My class, there were a lot of guys that wanted to go fly fighters. So inherently there's this competitiveness that is there. So the guys who I saw fail were ones who weren't willing to help others out. Hmm. So what we look for, and I can say this now, is like, as I was instructor, like if you and I went flying and I was instructing you on emergency landing patterns or something like that, and I provided you some techniques or tricks, at the end of the day, all the students in that flight, your 15 member, student group there, you get together and everyone goes around the room and shares lessons learned. Cause the goal is to learn from others' mistakes so that everyone can be better. And so what we look for is, would you share that information that I gave you? Or are you going to like hold that information close to the vest thinking that's going to give you an edge? Like it's not going to give you an edge.
Right.
Like there's a natural innate ability, I believe, of the monkey skills that people have. And obviously you can teach and improve, but if you're able to, as a student, help others out and bring others up, and this I think is really important in like military flight training, because again, you're doing it as a group more or less and you're competing. If you're able to teach and help others out, one, you're going to be better because obviously you understand the concepts that you're trying to pass along and it's going to make you stronger, but you're going to make the group stronger. And it's like the rising tides lift all ships theme there. And I think it's applicable there. So, when you go through pilot training in the Air Force, we have different, I mentioned we have like the aerobatics. We call that the contact phase or transition phase a little bit later on, instruments and formation. Well, when we get going, like initially it is drinking from a fire hose.
Yeah.
Because you might be doing academics in formation and flying contact or transition rides, and you're just trying to figure out how to do a Cuban 8, how to do emergency landing pattern, how to do a no flap pattern. But then you're going to do academics and you're going to do simulators in formation or instruments. And really, instruments is like the killer, right? You're doing all this studying for instruments. And I remember I was like, what is an ILS? as you're reading it and like it makes no sense, you've never seen it. And then you're like, you're trying to do emergency landing patterns, trying to go through your emergency procedures and nail all that down. And then you kind of, as you get a little bit further along, now you're opted, meaning, we call it like you're eligible basically per the syllabus to go fly a formation ride, an instrument ride, or like a navigation ride, whatever it might be. And it's just like, hey, the weather's bad. You thought you were going to do a formation ride and you had prep for a formation ride. You're going to do an instrument ride to some place you've never been to and shoot an ILS and an arc and holding, all the stuff that when you're new to it, it's like the end of the world.
Yeah.
So that's the balance, I think. And I don't know if that exists. like in the civilian world, you know, because again, people might be slightly different. Like you're paying, obviously you have to get through it, but you're paying someone to teach you so that you're a customer versus like the Air Force is like, suck it up, buttercup. Yeah, and if you don't get it, just like throw you're done.
The deep end. Yeah. For real. It sounds like that's more the style. Whereas like in the civilian side, people can just fire you and move on, you know? So you got to have some sort of positive way to carry them through. So I like what you talked about with the rising tide lifting all ships and basically the class helping together out. I feel like in the civilian side, we could do more of that. What are some other things, some positive things that people should have or that stood out to you as an instructor that they needed in order to, I guess, rise above the rest or just do well, just do their best really is all they can do, right?
Yeah, but I think, you know, the biggest thing is an attitude. Mm. You know, we had guys that would come in that had 3,000 hours flying RJs and were at the absolute top of their class. And then we also had the 3,000 hour RJ guy that would come in who was at the bottom of the class. Hmm. And it all came down to attitude. There obviously is like some left hand, right hand skills there that probably were lacking or excelling there. But I think when it comes down to it, like attitude can really get you a long way. Like you're learning something new that you've never done. So the expectation that you're good at it is not there by most. What, you know, as an instructor, I expect is like, hey, this information exists in a book or a video or a classmate that you should show up to the ride prepared. And when we're doing like a really, you know, in the Air Force, a formal training program, and when there's a syllabus, you know, on each ride, what the required items are that you do. So you need to show up with at least the knowledge of what those items are. So if we're talking about a Cuban 8, you need to know what the entry parameters are. Is it 300 to 400 knots? What are the minimum altitudes? Things like that. Maybe you don't quite conceptually know how to place those or how to go out there and fly it. That's what the ride's for. And that's what the instructor's right there for, is teach it. But you shouldn't show up and be like, hey, just tell me all your information. And I think that is probably applicable across, I mean, not just flying from military and civilian, but anytime you're learning something new is like having good attitude, work hard, show up prepared. Because if you do all that, you're going to be able to maximize the time of your instructor who's trying to teach you how to do this. I think all too often, not all too often, but there are definitely cases where people just would not prepare or they wouldn't show up. And then the attitude they would take about it is like, it's your problem that I don't understand this, which would quickly get sorted out in the Air Force, but maybe not in other places, you know? So,
right.
I definitely watch guys fall flat on their face because of attitude. And then guys who are struggling left hand, right hand, but had a great attitude and were just sponges trying to soak up as much information as possible and got through it.
You ever see anyone, or did you ever see anyone transition through that ego, the bad attitude, and come out the other side in a positive way? Or was it just so set that they didn't?
Definitely. I think after like a year of getting beaten down, like guys, and there were a couple in my class who I remember showing up, like I always take them in. I try to, of like showing up to any kind of new group with my mouth shut, ears open, and just to like assess. And also it helps me prevent from looking like an idiot because I usually don't have anything good to say. But I watch guys who would show up day one of class, like, hey, I'm going to be a fighter pilot. I'm going to go fly the Raptor. And then you hit the flight line and they're absolutely terrible. And for them, like it wrecks their world. And I don't know if it was just a lack of understanding of like what their capabilities might be or how difficult this might be. But then when they took those blows, like their attitude kind of turned sour and then they just fizzled out. And I think the guys who had a bad attitude that did poorly and that someone talked to them about, and then they kind of had a realization of where they stood and they did some self-assessment.
Right.
A couple of those guys kind of turned the corner and like by the end got through it successfully. And they were they weren't, you know, like chest pounding, I'm going to be the best fighter pilot in the world. It was just like, I'm trying to survive and trying to learn as much as possible. But I think it was probably pretty painful for them. And there's probably some awkward conversations that instructors gave them and things like that.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing actually how many parallels there are because a lot of people, just as an instructor that has a flight school, there are a lot of people that'll come in to the civilian side and they'll have the money and they'll have the time, which a lot of people you know, gripe about, but they don't have the work ethic to get it done, or they have an attitude like they can just do whatever they want without doing the study at home. So it's interesting to hear that that's still like a human element in the military.
Yeah, it's interesting that you would think that you get to this point or you're spending this amount of money that you would, I guess, let this opportunity fizzle or not put forth all your effort into it, you know, but I think it exists no matter where you go.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting. So you did the instructor pilot thing and now you're transitioning into, did you do tours of duty? Did you go to the F-16 first or where did you go from there?
So actually when I was an instructor, I went and did an MC-12, a King Air 350 deployment to Afghanistan. And I was doing intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance.
Okay.
This was a stopgap measure the Air Force put in place because we needed more UAVs, but they couldn't do it. So they bought a bunch of King Air 350s, loaded them up with a bunch of tech, and then pulled guys from across the Air Force to go fly them, which was really fortunate for me. In pilot training, I wanted to go fly the A-10. I didn't want to go fly the F-16 because I was like, everyone who flies an F-16 sucks. Like I just had a bad experience with all these guys who flew F-16s. But when I did the MC-12 deployment, I was actually surrounded by mostly F-16 guys who were all awesome. And I learned more about the mission, which course corrected me to put the F-16 down as my first choice, leaving my instructor tour as a fate. So I did the short stint in Afghanistan and then I came back to the T-6 for a few months. I had to do a spin up in the T-38 to fly something fast again before going through introduction to fighter fundamentals, which is a 6-week course. Flying the T-38, but you're kind of doing the basic fighter maneuvers, doing surface attack, introducing you to some of the concepts that you'll be flying in the F-16, the F-22, the F-15, going through that, which kind of lends to it. You know, I showed up to that program as a senior guy because I had spent 3 years instructing.
Right.
But most of the people in my class were straight or guys who I just taught to fly 6 months prior to that. So, you know, 3 or 4 years younger than me. And then some of the instructors I had, I'd actually deployed with in the MC-12.
Wow.
You know, there's a balance of how do you manage your experience? And it was a great opportunity for me to walk in there. Like if I walked in like, I got this figured out. I have all this flight time already. Like I would have been crushed,
right?
Like immediately. And some guys did that. Like they have a chip on their shoulder, like, I have my wings. I've already been flying. Like I proved myself. So balancing that was, I think, something I did well, but it could have gone south. And I actually had a guy I was flying with on one of my upgrade rides who I deployed with. And one of the things I kind of said back then, like, if you told me something, I'd be like, yep, that checks. And I would do that in the jet flying. We got back. He's like, hey man, just so you know you don't mean it this way, but when you say that, it sounds like you already know what you're talking about and that you don't need me back there. And so it was a perception thing, but I was like, man, I'm really glad you said that to me because it's early on. And he knows me and knows that I wasn't doing that in a disrespectful manner, but it kind of goes to show too, you never know what actions you're doing or what you're saying and how it might be perceived because perception is reality.
Yeah.
And that could have been pretty detrimental to my training for sure.
Yeah. That's really interesting that you had so many different peers from different levels, but yeah, I mean, and then you probably saw it on the instruction level where you can't go in with a hot head and think you're above anyone else. You're in it together, you know, again.
Yeah. Right. You're just one of the dudes and you're on the same level. Doesn't matter the fact that you have more experience. It'd be like one of those guys rolling into pilot training who have 3,000 hours in the RJ. The guys who rolled in and they're like, hey, I'm brand new to this. Teach me how the Air Force flies. I want to learn that. Did well. The guys who rolled in is like, I already know how to do this. Did not do well. Like everyone knows you know how to fly an ILS and it's going to be really beneficial to you in a couple months when you're doing instruments and you can help your peers out. But you don't need to say it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's real interesting. Moving from the instruction into F-16, what was that process like? What is it like to, is it really actually much different than doing the T-6 and the T-38? Like, do you still have to go through all the same systems and maneuvers and everything? What's it like?
You do, like the syllabus kind of flows in a similar manner. Like when you get, you're going to learn how to take off and land. You're going to learn how to shoot an ILS. Then you're going to go do, you're always kind of doing formation in F-16, but then you're going to start bringing in the tactics and the weaponeering and things like that. So it flows along a similar path to do it, but inherently, you know, obviously they're completely different and there's a lot more complexity that goes into F-16 mm-hmm. than there is the T-6. But I think at that point, showing up in F-16, I had been through 4 different training programs in the Air Force. And again, it was just kind of copy and paste and just change out for the F-16 stuff, which I definitely think helped the pacing of going through training and knowing like, hey, I need to be ready for X, Y, and Z, but I don't need to worry about this right now. That's going to be something right. I worry about. Cause I always say, what's the nearest alligator to the boat? Like you definitely need to worry about the nearest alligator and kill the nearest alligator because you can't kill them all. And that's kind of like when it goes through Air Force training, you just have to be ready for everything, but you got to figure out what do you really need to be ready for.
And so because you were an instructor, you saw where those alligators were for a lot of people and you knew where to do it for the F-16 and your other ratings as well.
I think it definitely helped. And I'm not saying that other people couldn't figure it out. There's right. no like, you know, crystal ball to it, but I definitely think knowing what the system, you know, how it's kind of designed and what the flow of the system and, you know, translated, I did my ATP and an A320 sim and then going through the 777, you know, training, like the flow is kind of the same when it comes to like the simulators of setting up for takeoff, landing, V1 cuts, engine outs, things like that, you know? So you kind of like figure out what the tempo is, what the expectation is, like that knowing is half the battle, you know? And if you kind of can anticipate what you need to know, then it definitely helps out, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a good lesson for everyone too, because the Airbus is so much different from the Boeing in a lot of ways. But just knowing what is coming is super important. And even in the FAA way, the civilian way, everything is out there and published. Like you can just get it and find out. Like there's no surprises when it comes to what you're going to face next. So
yeah, that's help yourself out. Like it's out there in the public domain. It's, you know, when I go, you know, for my type ride, like, you know what the requirements are of the FAA to give you your type rating, like what they have to see and things like that. So you should prepare for that, you know, and there's different ways you can do that. It's not necessarily, you need to prepare for life and flying outside of it. But sometimes when it comes to the check ride and the test, like, you know what the test is going to be more or less.
Right.
You know,
it's all there on paper.
Build you a little island around that. Mm-hmm. But like anything, I guess everything goes wrong on check ride. So also keep that in mind.
Yeah, it's true.
You know,
do you guys have like a check ride equivalent in the Air Force when you go through an aircraft, or do you essentially just get through and you're done?
So when you're going through pilot training, you don't have your wings yet. So you're not rated. So the check rides, you do check rides in pilot training. I kind of equate them to like a stage check maybe.
Okay.
So you do, you know, and then the contact, so your takeoffs and landings and aerobatics, you'll do a check ride. And guys, that's like a 50% bust rate. I mean, that's what it was. And then you just redo that ride. There's no like permanent record or anything like that that goes towards like your FAA license. Hmm. It's an Air Force internal thing. So there's a contact, an instrument, a formation. Now I'm thinking blanking on, I think there's one more too, but I've now like, that penguin fell off the iceberg a long time ago.
Yeah.
But if you fail those rides, it triggers review rides and you only get one like extra one. And if you fail that, like now you're kind of in hot water. Like you really can't fail or bust any other rides through that T6 program or that T38 program. Once you can move on to, once you graduate from the T38 or T1, you get your wings. Now you're a rated pilot. So rated pilots now get check rides that follow you for the rest of your career. We call them form eights. So when you show up to the C-17, the F-16, whatever major weapon system, you're going to go through a transition phase. And that's takeoff, landing, instrument approaches. And F-16, I think it was like 6 rides, maybe 5 rides. So you get several simulators, emergency procedure simulators, instrument procedure simulators. And then you get 5 rides. Actually go out there, you fly out to the area, you do some maneuvers, you fly some formation, you shoot an instrument approach, you do some emergency landing patterns, And that's it. You do those like rinse, repeat 5 times. And then on your 6th ride, someone chases you in another F-16 and observes you from the other aircraft.
Wow.
And evaluates you. So, you know, you're like, hey, you have to touch down the first 1,000 feet of the runway, or they're looking for your smoke when your wheels touch down. If you touch down outside of that, it's not necessarily a bust, but it might be a downgrade, things like that. Another piece of it, you'll do an emergency sim in conjunction with that, which is a separate event. And they'll put you through the ringer doing our bold face or CAPS, critical action procedures, things you have to know by memory that you can't pull a checklist out, like an engine failure or engine fire.
Right.
We want you to know that without having the checklist out.
That's pretty wild. That doesn't seem like a lot of flights to transition to a new aircraft. I mean,
yeah,
that requires like a lot of just book work time, right? And study time. Is that mostly where it's loaded?
I think, you know, the Office of the Air Force has done this a bunch and they figured out, hey, this is the sweet spot as far as what guys need. There are people that maybe on like their 3rd ride, like, yeah, that wasn't so great. I'm going to hook you on this ride and they're going to get an additional ride. Mm. But it is, you know, I mean, it's pretty quick, 5 rides. And then, hey, now you're instrument qualified to fly the F-16. Like you're not qualified, you know, in the mission, but you can go take off, land, fly in weather, fly in formation, whatever you need to do. But I would say it's probably like 5 or 6 simulators that are dedicated and the 5 rides roughly. And it's probably changed a little bit, but chair flying, studying, you know, I would sit in front of a paper cockpit display and just practice my flows and things like that early on, like in the T6 and T38. Ironically enough, I think the F-16 is definitely easier to start. There's less switches you have to flip when you're first learning it. Once you start getting into combat loadouts and things like that, you're doing a lot of work the entire time and ground procedures.
So you talked about mission training. Is that specific when you're, just tell us about that. What is that? What's mission training?
Yeah. So once you get your instrument qualification, you finish the transition phase in that plane. In the F-16, it's a 9-month program. So you spend about, you know, maybe 5 weeks getting through the academics in those first 5 rides. And then the remaining roughly 8 months or so is all missionized, trying to figure out, hey, how do you go out there and fight BFM or dogfighting, basic fighter moving? How do you go out there and do that 1v1? How do you go out there now and do that with 2 good guys and 1 bad guy tumbling through the sky? How do you go out there and fight long range air to air missile, you know, fights? We call it like DCA, defensive counter air. So protecting a spot. There's a lot of complexity that goes into that. And then you move into like air to ground phase. So learning how to drop bombs, what you need, you know, how to mix everything together. And so there's a lot that goes into that. And then really, once you leave the B course, that's the program of F-16 training or any kind of fighter training for that matter, you're going to show up to your first operational squadron and you're still not qualified to go out there and fight in the plane. You'll do another 6 months of missionized training at that base. And then you'll get your mission check is what we call it. And that's another form aid. That's a formal check ride that will follow you for the rest of your career. And all it is, you go out there and you're doing some kind of missionized sortie that your unit specializes in. So at Shaw in South Carolina, where I was, it was suppression of enemy air defenses, the Wild Weasel mission. So kick the door down in some country, get them to look at you and shoot their surface air missiles at you. So you can find them, locate them, disrupt, destroy, and annoy them. So people who are going into the target area, whether it be to drop bombs, pick up survivors, whatever it might be, that was our mission. Which is really complex. There's a lot of technicality that goes into it, but that would be your check ride. You'd go out there and do some kind of scenario where you were doing suppression of enemy air defenses and they're scoring your weapons employment. You know, how well, like as a young weeman, are you staying visual? Are you staying in formation? Are you following the proper procedures just like to and from? Usually as a wingman, like we call it VFR, if you can stay visual, like in formation, like you win at that point. Like don't hit your flight lead. And ideally, you know, you can employ some kind of weapon, but really it just needs you visual information.
Jeez. Okay. Check rides with the FAA are very easy. I have just learned.
I think my most complex check ride I had was a large force exercise where it's not even like realistic, but this is the scenario we had. We went out with like 16 good guy aircraft. So it was a big, day and a half long planning session that went into it and go out there and fly. And we had F-22s as our red air. So we're out there fighting F-22s, which we can't see. And like, it was super painful, but you know, that's what it is.
That's wild, man. Jeez. Gosh. Okay. So what was your career in the F-16 from there? I mean, where did you go? What did you do?
I was fortunate. I showed up to the F-16 and I deployed pretty much right away. So all I wanted to do since September 11th was get back
right
at the people that, attacked our country. Mm-hmm. And while I did that in the MC-12, it wasn't kinetic. We're out there hunting people and finding people so other people could kill them. But in the F-16, when I showed up, ISIS popped up on the map about 2 months after I showed up to my squadron. We were going to deploy just to do like a training deployment to be in the region to show our presence. And then it quickly switched by the time we got there to fighting ISIS. So it was a really busy deployment. And I think our unit dropped the most precision guided weapons of any F-16 unit up until that point. That record was subsequently broken every single time a new unit showed up of how busy it was. And so I was really fortunate because that's what I really wanted to go out there and do.
Right.
Serve the country and do it. And I was able to do that in the F-16. So we did that deployment, came back, and I spent 2 more years kind of training and prepping for the next evolution of a deployment cycle. And right towards the end of that, I was actually going to go teach at Holloman Air Force Base. So teach the next round of F-16 students coming up. Mm. I was hired as the F-16 demo pilot. So I spent the last two and a half years of my Air Force active duty time doing the F-16 demos. So traveling across the globe, doing air shows, which was a lot of fun. And it was a completely change of pace from just normal like combat ops and combat preparation in F-16.
That's interesting. So you went from combat to the demo pilot job pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a complete switch, and like there's no, you can fly tactical sorties still like training wise and helping out, but it usually just never worked out with like the tempo. Like I would occasionally try to go fly some tactical sorties and things like that to sharpen my dull sword, so to speak. But, it usually just didn't happen too often.
Was it pretty busy on the road as a demo pilot? I mean, there's lots of air shows going on during the summertime. Were you at many of them like in a row?
Yeah, I would say my time in the F-16 was pretty busy. My first 24 months at Shaw, I was probably home like 17 or 18 months of that. I had about a year before the demo that I was home for the most part. But then when I took over the demo job, on average gone like 200 to 250 days a year. And you're typically from February, March-ish to November, we would schedule 20 air shows. And sometimes those air shows would be strung back to back to back where you would just stay on the road. Sometimes we would come back and have like a day or two off. And by off, usually you're back at work doing travel vouchers, doing paperwork, preparing for the next air show. So it just varied. The maintenance team, those guys really put in the hours and days. So there were times where, it was easy for me to get back to South Carolina in F-16.
Right.
But it was challenging with connecting flights and things like that for them to get back. So they would stay on the road even longer just because it was easier for them to go to the next location versus come home and then go to where we're going. I think on average, we're probably gone to 25 to 30 events every year, because not only do we do air shows, but we did the flyover, the Super Bowl, Indy 500, the Belmont Stakes. So you start adding in these like different little trips that are 3 days here or 5 days there. Like it starts eating into your time where it's not just air shows, but I think all said and done, I did somewhere around, like 50 plus air shows.
Wow. So it almost seems like it's actually a really official crew and you're all like deployed by the military in a way. I know that word probably you don't want to play with that word, but, so you have like a crew that you guys would all travel with and you were the demo crew. Is that correct?
Yeah. So your demo team, and the nice thing that the Air Force does that is different than the Navy. So the Air Force, there's one demo pilot for the F-16, the A-10, the F-22, and now the F-35. each one of those teams has a dedicated set of maintenance members. So it is slightly different amongst the team. The A-10 and the F-16 team both have three aircraft that are assigned to the teams. It's easier to keep it that way because of all the configuration changes and things like that. But if you look at the F-22 and the F-35, it's always a clean jet, right? Mm-hmm. The F-16 can have wing tanks, targeting pods, you know, harm targeting system, all these things strapped on it. So it's easier just give the team, like the fourth gen teams, as we call it, give them their jets, let them keep them clean in a demo configuration. So you're not always reconfiguring aircraft. And then the demo team maintainers, they are responsible for all the maintenance that goes on. And there's a lot more of the behind the scenes. So for any one demonstration sortie, which might last 15 minutes, you know, the team is probably putting in on a good day, 8 hours of work dedicated purely to preparing that jet, post-flighting that jet. And then I know, like for me, routinely would break them. And that's just a lot more work on the guys. There's one weekend, for instance, I know we had three of our aircraft, all three motors were pulled and they're doing motor swaps. Like for me, it was eye-opening as a pilot to see the process, you know, and they would let me like come out and like turn a wrench and feel like I was part of the team and feel important. Mm-hmm. But they're putting in a tremendous amount of effort to do it just to keep the jets flying and make sure they're staying on their schedules as far as the preventative maintenance that goes into it as well.
Yeah. And I can imagine you guys have your own set of, you know, we call them ADs in the FAA, little things that need to be checked, and they're constantly going through those things, especially since you're using them so fast. And really you've got to have that on the deployment side too, right? Especially in harsher conditions where you're using ordnance, and I don't know if you guys were in the desert and dealing with sand and dust, but that's got to be a pretty wild process too.
Yeah. You know, it's funny that, so my last deployment, the interesting piece was while we were really busy flying, the jets actually, once the jets get to wherever they're going, anytime you change climate, it usually takes like a month for them to like adjust, right? Like you show up from a cold climate to hot climate, like they're leaking fluid all over the place, seals break, and the jets just have to adjust. But after that, like adjustment period, then especially in combat, because everyone is focused on combat, there's no extra frills. There's, I mean, for the most part, there's no extra like BS that goes into, hey, doing this random training. Like everyone's focused on making sure the jets are healthy and flying. And then I think too, everyone appreciates that there's no margin for error. Like that there's never like any tolerance for errors, but it even gets even tighter for whatever reason when we go deploy.
Right.
You know, I had buddies who had zero oil pressure, lost all their, you know, fuel, like just bad spots with like no good guys around for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles, like not where you want to be in a single seat fighter, you know? So the maintainers are the ones that make it all happen. My demo team, like time was purely the best part of my career because of the team that I had and like their dedication to making sure the jet was ready to fly and all the effort and energy they put into it was pretty awesome.
So what goes into planning your routine that you're doing as you fly around these different airports?
So for each Air Force demo team, it's a script and it's actually signed off by the general. You like the 4-star, there's a big certification process that you have to go through in order to be able to fly the demonstration, but you can't really modify it. You can change a few things here and there, which is usually the repositions or the one thing that you have say in versus a split S versus doing a 45 degree checkoff. That's about it. Everything else is start to finish in order. Like if you knock off a maneuver in the middle of it, like you don't go pick that back up. Like you just keep moving in sequence. You don't adjust anything. The Canadians, like they'll actually draft a new demo profile every single year. They let the demo pilot pick it and kind of go through it. But for whatever reason, we just keep it as is. I think in the end too, like you look, you're buying more risk by doing it, right? Like you're flying at 600 knots, really low to the ground. Like you hit a bird, like it's going to do a lot of damage. So you're buying more risk by doing it. So just inherently by making a lot of jet noise, like most people find that pretty cool.
Yeah.
They're like the pure, like, you know, aerobatic, like dudes out there like, oh man, it'd be really cool if you did this and that. It's like, you know, you're out there to impress 98% of the people, not the 2% who are like world aerobatic champions. Mm-hmm. You're just trying to get out there and spread the good message of the Air Force and get people excited about what the military is doing and maybe that, you know, opportunity to join and yeah, do something in the Air Force.
Yeah, that's really cool. I always thought it would be, and maybe you have some thoughts on this, I always thought it'd be cool to kind of own that airspace for a bit and just play around like you do. Not play around. Like, obviously, we've laid out that this is a very structured process, but it just seems so cool. Some of your footage. I remember our mutual friend Josh that works for Garmin, he put a 360 cam in your cockpit. And you went over the runway at Oshkosh and they had a fire line that blew up as that. And, you know, you like zoomed down anyway. It's really cool. So what's that feeling like to just be up there performing, or is it just business as usual?
I was definitely really focused during it. But first, like, I think Josh, like he transformed the game as far as the camera. Like, he showed me that video. I wasn't quite sold to begin with. And then after that sortie he showed to me, I was like, this is going to melt the internet. And I think it did.
Yep.
But, you know, going out there in a demo profile, I would typically burn somewhere between in 15 minutes, burn 300 to 600 calories. So like, you're working really hard and really focused. There are definitely times where you can like catch your breath and like, this is awesome. And like there are times like flying around like Miami, South Beach, like zipping between buildings are some of those moments where like, this is pretty cool. But definitely like focused. And, you know, I'm always worried, you know, especially when I'm doing, like, for instance, like offsite locations away from the airport, like, when's my motor going to quit? Where am I going to go? When's my motor going to quit? You know,
right.
Or thinking through the contingencies and just planning and prepping and just kind of always keeping your guard up, because it is really cool and it is a lot of fun, but it's also a lot of work. And if you don't respect it very quickly, it can bite you. That's not saying like I didn't have fun doing it, but it was pretty awesome sometimes just to be like, here you go. Here's 5 miles and you can pretty much do whatever you want that normally you'd go to jail for.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of what I think. Yeah. And, you know, super impressive to see from the ground. It's just, and you really do get a patriotic pride whenever you see demo teams. And so I just really actually appreciate what you guys do and what you did. I know it's like in the past now, but really, really has cool. Been. In fact, I think it was last year, the year before at Oshkosh, they had more demo teams than usual. And it was a very loud air show all the time. And some people were complaining. I'm like, we need more. Give us more.
Sound of freedom.
Exactly. Did you ever link up on the Heritage flight as well when they do that?
Yeah, for me, I think that's like the best part. So all the demo pilots go through a 1 week course in February, Heritage Flight Training Conference down in at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base in Tucson, Arizona. And you have to do that every year. And there's about 10 civilian pilots that are certified to fly the Warbirds alongside Air Combat Command, ACC, modern fighters. So it's a really tight-knit group and it's a really awesome thing to happen. Because I remember watching it actually at my local air show growing up, the Viper demo and a P-51. I think it's Lee Lauterbach actually flying it. And I got to fly with Lee, you know, fast forward like 15 years later on his wing and a Viper, which is really cool to kind of like have the full circle. But that piece of it, I think the coolest thing, because I just absolutely love the Mustang, which I think most people do. You can actually hear that Merlin motor like in the cockpit of the F-16 when you're on the wing. So that is one of those when you're like right there next to it and you can hear the engine. You're like, all right, this is pretty cool.
You know? And it's pretty vanilla, right? Because you guys aren't doing anything crazy. You're just staying tight and doing laps. But I mean, it's all planned again, right? I mean, that's what that conference is for. You guys plan the routine.
Yeah. And you try, I mean, because again, you're trying to remove variables that don't need to be there, right? Make it predictable. The challenge of the F-16 is that last pass you do, you're pulling about 9.5 Gs, you know, for 10 seconds or so, going about 630 knots, right to rejoining from this priceless World War II Warbird with no ejection seat, and you're flying 3 feet from it. So you really just have to like, it's a big adjustment. I mean, you're running like full speed ahead to now you are literally on the backside of the power curve of the F-16 hanging on the blades on the wing there. So you don't want to kill them.
Right.
You want to be safe, you know? So it's a little bit of a challenge, but it's definitely fun.
What kind of conversations have you had on the ground with, maybe young impressionable people that were perhaps inspired by these demos?
I think a lot of people that I talked to that kind of stick out of my mind. You know, like one, they like didn't think they could ever do it, right? And they either hear my story or, you know, another pilot who's with me, their story, like what my beginning was, that like it's possible for anyone to do this with, you know, somebody like, obviously if you have some kind of heart issue or things like that, like right. there are showstoppers for it. But knowing like these are opportunities out there for anyone and trying to reach more people to let them know that, hey, this is an option. If you have an interest to go out there and serve your country and do it, like this is here. And I think for me, when you hear like, you know, kids get excited about that and how awesome that was, it's really cool. The big thing, you know, social media was something new to me. Instagram was something new to me. And I went back and forth and I go back and forth as if I keep it or not. But like just, you know, yesterday I had someone send me a message. He's like, hey, I just want to update you. I got accepted into ROTC. You know, watching everything you're doing is a huge inspiration. So hopefully, you know, there's some positive things that come out of social media that expand, you know, the reach for demo teams, things that, you know, people at air shows are actually able to connect via social media and, you know, seeing that come full circle or seeing their progression towards their goals is really inspiring and rewarding.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's the best part of social media. And I'd imagine that on your end of it, you guys actually get some pretty vile things just for being military and doing what you do, which is really unfortunate. But we don't need to go there.
Yeah, but I think the only negative I had was when we killed Soleimani, or however you say his name, the Iranian.
Yeah.
I think I have a lot of Iranian followers.
Yeah, Combat Learjet had issues with that too on his Instagram. It was pretty nasty.
Yeah. And so it's the Iranian bots.
Yeah, it's odd, man. I don't know where that came from. Anyway, I think, you know, stuff like that and you know, just the position you're in and how long you said it takes to go through that process, you may actually not hear about those stories for a while now where people actually get through, because there still is so much work ahead for many of them. But I can imagine those stories have to come someday.
Yeah, you hope. Cabo Gunderson, who's the F-22 demo pilot, he has a cool picture with John York Screech, who was an F-15 demo pilot when he was a kid. I don't know, maybe he's like 8 or 9.
No way.
Fast forward, Cabo's going through F-15 training and his instructor is Screech.
No way.
So it's really cool to like, and now Cabo is the demo pilot to like see, like that's full circle right there.
Yeah.
And obviously it took like 15, 16 years for that to happen, if not more. But those stories are out there. And I think you just never know the connection you make with someone or when you meet someone, the impact you'll have. And you may never see that impact, but that's why I think you can't waste any opportunity anytime you come in contact with someone, especially someone who's young, because this might be their only exposure to the military, or this might be their only exposure to pilot, whatever it might be. You, like everyone, can have a lasting impression on other people. They just have right. to realize that how important that interaction is.
Yeah. Yeah. And you guys do a great job at that, or you were doing a great job at it out on the flight line. I remember seeing you all out there, just really, really cool. And, you know, I really appreciate the military, all you guys do. And I don't know. It's a pride I can't really explain until I hear the anthem and hear the heritage flight. Like it's just kind of personal. You know what I mean? I don't know if that makes sense, but it's absolutely. So deep that it's hard to explain. So I appreciate all you guys do. And thank you for your service, by the way. I could say that 1,000 times, but thank you for your service and all your buddies too. Let's talk a little bit about just really briefly your transition to civilian side. So you've done that recently and tell us what that process has been like, what it's like to have a different job now.
Yeah, it's I can say, like, I don't stress very much, but in the past like 10 months of my life, I've never had more stress, because you're going from, hey, I have a paycheck on the 1st and the 15th of the month to, am I getting hired by this airline? Am I not? Am I going to start training? Now I finally got to the point where I'm, you know, in the rhythm of flying the line or sitting reserve, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. Although right now I've been flying a ton, which is awesome. And now I'm fully appreciating the benefits of the other side. I'm still an Air Force reservist, not flying. So I still have that connection back to the Air Force, but going through like flying a 777 is slightly heavier than an F-16. I think my my last flight, I had about 150,000 pounds of cargo, wow, and 170,000 pounds of fuel. So an F-16 weighs about 30,000 pounds, you know, on average.
Crazy.
So it's night and day different as far as what I was doing. And I really enjoy, it's a different thing. I enjoy learning. There are things obviously that matter much more in the 777 than the F-16 and vice versa. Learning what those are and how to like fit, how to be good at flying the 777 is a unique and different challenge, you know, like, I don't know. It's growing as an aviator and then learning new stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've always loved that airplane too. And with your company, we don't have to say your company, but you guys have newer models, don't you? Some that were made fairly recently.
Yeah, they're still buying. I think we have two that are going to be delivered this summer, and the fleet's just going to keep expanding. Yep. It produces a lot of revenue and it's very fuel efficient, maintenance efficient. And you know, I remember friends' dads who went to fly the 777 when it first hit the line at Delta, and you know, just kind of be like, oh, that's a really cool plane, and not really fully grasping it and understanding it. And to be honest, I probably didn't fully grasp it or understand it until like the first time landing it for real. But it's such a nimble aircraft. I don't know. It's a massive beast, and for it to be as responsive as it is and like handle as well as it does, it's just kind of cool. And it's kind of crazy to me.
Yep. Yep. Great engineering.
Yeah.
last question. So I kind of end here usually, and that is, what would your advice be for those that are looking to get into aviation and maybe even on the military side specifically?
Yeah, I think it's a long road. Typically it's a long road. They're going to be set back. They're going to be hurdles, and you have to like push through those and know that you're not the first person to have those issues and to run into them. And everyone's going to have slightly different obstacles. Like maybe you're struggling with landing and someone else didn't, you know, but know that everyone struggles at some point, and the attitude you have to overcome that and push forward is key. Pushing forward and keeping after it is the most important thing. And doing that with a good attitude, it'll make or break it. In my opinion,
it's so interesting because typically, obviously, the people that are on this podcast are pilots that have had a successful career, and that is always the advice in like a different form, one way or another. Like you just have to keep pushing through. So it was great to hear that story from your perspective, because we all know that the military, especially to get to a fighter pilot position, is very difficult. So it's great to hear that. Now, you have a really nice microphone there. You started a podcast recently, didn't you? So
I did. The Afterburn podcast.
Cool.
So I'm kind of taking, it's, you know, similar spin, trying to bring people together with not just aviation stories. Obviously, that's a lot of the focus. I actually just had an episode released today with a former Green Beret, Caleb Brewer, who stepped on a pressure plate IED in Afghanistan, lost his legs below the knee, one above the knee. And I met him while I was being taught how to surf after an air show. And like, I was struggling, like you read about, trying to figure out how to stand up on the surfboard, and Caleb's over there surfing, no big deal. And to me, that was just like, this dude,
wow,
he lost his legs and he is over here surfing and I'm just floundering, like ready to give up. Like, you know, to me, it was a big inspiration. So I'm trying to bring together people with different stories. We're talking about military aviation. We're talking about the military. We're talking about just life in general, because I think, again, everyone has setbacks. Everyone has some kind of story that they have learned from. And if we can bring those stories out and share them, then hopefully someone can learn from them and then make their journey, their path a little bit easier.
Yeah, I love that. Cool. So you can obviously find that anywhere. iTunes, Spotify, it's probably everywhere, huh?
Yeah, iTunes, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, iHeartRadio. Again, the Afterburn podcast. And then I have Rainwaters 27 on Instagram, which has got a bunch of links there. And then the old glory days and the F-16.
Yep. Yep. I'm sure everyone will be flocking over there. All right, man. Hey, I appreciate you taking time with us today. Again, thanks for your service and those of your friends and family, and we'll keep in touch.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I look forward to flying together one of these days.
That would be amazing. I'll be down in Atlanta at some point. I'm sure we'll make it happen. Or, hey, you can come to Alaska if you've ever wanted to fly in Alaska.
Yeah, I want to do some Alaskan flying. I think that'd be fun.
Sounds good. I can't offer an F-16. I've got a 172, but the views are great. I promise.
Yeah, let's make it happen, man. That'd be awesome.
All right. Appreciate it.
Talk soon. Cheers, brother.
Okay. If you're like me, that was just an awesome interview. I'm so grateful that John joined us today. John, again, thank you for your service and all you've done and your continued service. And I actually started listening to your podcast, that most recent one with the Green Beret. Really enjoying it, man. Top quality podcast and looking forward to listening to more. So go ahead and go check out Major John Rainwaters at his podcast, The Afterburn, or you can find him on Instagram, Rainwaters27. Lots of amazing videos there. And again, just really appreciate him being here. All right. So you may find this podcast on YouTube. Please subscribe if you will and hit that notification bell. That way you'll see this interview and more material coming out from us, like our weekly Ask the CFI sessions, where you ask flight training, aviation career questions, anything you need. I answer those live on Instagram every Monday. We also have a vlog where we, you know, that's more of an entertaining side of some of the flying exploits I get to do as I travel around and flying here in Alaska and many other things in between. There's lots coming from us. So subscribing, you actually get quite a bit. So if you need ground school with private or instrument, that's currently what's available. In the future, we'll have commercial and CFI ground school, or you're working on a check ride. We also have check ride preparation. We have all of that ground school and check ride preparation at angleofattack.com. And that helps you out in more an official way to actually work toward your license. All right. Hope you guys are doing well in this time of uncertainty. But what I am certain about is that we will make it through this and that we can make some positive things come about from everything that's going on right now. So I encourage you to keep doing that. All right. Keep the blue side up. And until next time, throttle on.
We sincerely thank you for joining us on Aviator Cast. Please subscribe through your favorite podcast service and leave a review. Check out more flight training resources at angleofattack.com. There you can find this podcast, many free aviation training videos, as well as online ground school for private instrument, commercial, and CFI. Got a check ride coming up? Check Ride Ace from Angle of Attack is your ultimate companion, guiding you through the process so you can conquer your big day. Thanks once again for joining us on Aviator Cast. Turn left, contact Ground Point Niner.